Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
There are just some players that I have seen over the years at Oregon and Oregon State where I leave the game going, I really like the way this guy plays. Like Lyle Moivau, the former quarterback at Oregon State, like the way he plays. Braylon Addison, former receiver at Oregon, just like the way he plays. Tim Ewes was one of those guys, former tight end at Oregon State, played hard, made plays, did a lot of little things that don't show up in the box score at the end of the game. And he's still doing that stuff today, and he's joining us now. Do you miss being on the field, Tim?
No, my body does not miss it one bit, John. But thanks for having me on the show today.
You bet. You know, you're a kid who grew up in this state. Like, how soon or how early in your life did you go, I want to be a Beaver, or did you entertain the idea of being a Duck at any time?
You know, growing up in Eugene, I'm obviously going to games all the time. I was there for a lot of big wins. I remember the Ducks beating BYU with Troy Detmer and obviously Kenny Wheaton's big pick against Washington. So I was there for a lot of big games in Autzen. But when it really came down to the opportunity that Oregon State was giving me with a full scholarship and a chance to study engineering versus a walk-on position at Oregon and not really a major that I was interested in studying, it became a pretty simple decision at that point when you're talking scholarship dollars. So my dad was always a Beaver growing up, you know, since the Terry Baker era. So we always had some Beaver ties, but pretty simple decision dollar sense wise.
Kid went to Churchill High School. You played multiple sports, and even at Oregon State, I think as a freshman, you were on the basketball team with the Beavers. Is that right?
I was one of the craziest things I've ever tried to do in my life. I really respected and loved watching Tony Gonzalez. That was kind of a guy that I really was inspired by as a high schooler, watching him at Cal, and really wanted to give it a shot at Oregon State. And it is such a difficult thing to do. And it just shows how great of an athlete Tony Gonzalez really was compared to me. So
was the challenge that you know, because you're playing basketball, which probably helped you as a tight end in football with good feet, but was the challenge trying to do the off season stuff while competing in season and in one sport, or was it just your body didn't get a chance to rest, or what was the challenging part of it?
Yeah. You know, at that point, I believe the first day of basketball was like September 15th. So we had barely started. I actually remember my first basketball practice. We were Oregon State was playing down at Stanford, and I remember going over to Gill in the morning and just being in such terrible shape for basketball. I thought I would be in great shape because I've been playing football, you know, in fall camp and all of those things, but just totally different conditioning. And had a huge breakfast before, and you know, Coach Payne is kind of looking at me like, are you really eating that much food? And then, you know, I lost it about probably a half hour into practice and just went back and laid in my dorm bed listening and watching the Beaver game. I think it was on Fox Sports Net at that point, or Northwest, something like that. And just thinking, what am I doing? And it got better. Obviously, I got in shape. I didn't do any of the winter conditioning for football. I did all of the weightlifting. And that was probably the most difficult time in my life training, because I really don't remember my winter quarter at Oregon State, because it was wake up, it's dark, go lift weights, get home after basketball practice, training table and study table, and it's dark. And that was life for 4 or 5 months. It was a rough go, and that's why I didn't do it after that. So
Tim Ewes, our guest, former Oregon State tight end, played in the NFL with multiple teams, including the Bills, the Saints, Steelers, and Cardinals. You were there at Oregon State kind of in, you know, the transition, the whiplash between Mike Riley, Dennis Erickson, back to Mike Riley. What was that like to be in the football program as that was shifting?
Yeah, it's a good question. Coach Riley had offered me a scholarship in my junior year. And that was a little unheard of back then. Now I feel like guys are getting offered as freshmen in high school. But it was my junior year, and he had asked me to come on board and be part of the turnaround that he was really selling to me as a student athlete. And it was a whiplash. I remember him leaving for the pros, and I was getting ready to come up on my official visit and commit the next weekend. And to kind of be stuck in limbo because I'd already kind of told Colorado State and Boise State no, and those were the other schools I was looking at. And I remember Jason Lewis's dad, one of my high school basketball teammates, he was at the game that night, and he came down to me and he goes, "Did you just hear who Oregon State hired?" I said, I have no idea. Who did they hire? And he goes, "Dennis Erickson." And I was like, I don't know who that is. That doesn't help me right now. I'm getting ready for this basketball game. And then he's like, "He's got two national championships. This is going to be amazing for you." And it ended up being a pretty special experience playing for Coach Erickson.
I kind of feel like if Riley had just stayed, it would have been better. Or if Erickson had just stayed, it would have been better. But kind of the going back and forth, it just causes a little disruption. And maybe Oregon State came out of that a little bit. You know, maybe Riley eventually got it figured out, but it had to be hard for the athletes who were caught in that washing machine-like experience, Tim Uwis being one of them. He's joining us now. You got kids now who play sports. What's it like to be a dad in a pandemic with kids who are trying to play sports?
Oh, it is crazy, and it's been something that is we're adjusting, I feel like, every day, every week, every month. And so, you know, at the beginning last March with kind of a full shutdown, we really weren't able to do a whole lot. And kind of as things began to open up in June, volleyball started being played again, mainly sand, outdoor volleyball. And that's what my daughter is a part of down at G3 Club. And then my boys started playing, or my old son, Timmy Jr., started playing squad baseball. And it's kind of a travel team. And my youngest son was doing golf. He's taking some golf lessons from an Oregon legend, Dean Roberts, and played basketball in high school with his son, Ryan. And then my youngest daughter doing ballet all by Zoom. And so as things started to open up, we started playing tournaments, limited number of parents at tournaments. But there was always this disconnect between what we could do as like a club organization and what OSAA was allowing us to do with our high school athletes as a high school coach. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration and parents started to build up. And then we got into the fall and we played flag football through the YMCA in Albany. But again, no high school football season. And there was a lot of upset parents seeing kids out playing football and their kids weren't allowed to. So it's been really weird and unique because my kids have been able to participate while older kids have almost been penalized through the pandemic.
We were talking about this earlier, just sort of the inequity that's been caused because, you know, you've got some families who can afford to play club or can afford to go out of the state. You have a lot of other families that can't. And, you know, those kids are being left behind. How do you think we fix that?
Man, I'm really concerned about that on all levels, from academics to athletics. I don't know what the fix is. Right now, the fix is we have to figure out how to open things up on some level, and we have to figure out how to get sports, kind of the purity of sports, back to, I think, probably the maybe like fourth, fifth grade level, middle school level. The time that kids really start realizing that there's other things out there besides playing in the backyard. And we saw a huge disparity, especially like Little League local Corvallis, where I've coached in the Little League here for a number of years. And the kids that kind of played club throughout the off season or through COVID, I'll call it the off season. And then the kids that came to tryouts this year that hadn't picked a bat up in almost 2 years. And it was almost a danger for those kids to be out there. And so we're trying to figure out how to get them coached up. But I really feel there's just probably going to be a lag in the state of Oregon with that disparity for the next few years. And that's, and academically, I share the same kind of question and concern. So I'm actually running for local school board because I believe we have to fit, you know, catching up academically is a little easier than I think catching up athletically, but that's a different subject. So
I love that you're rolling up your sleeves and you're getting involved, because a lot of us will bellyache, but very few of us are willing to go and say, all right, I'm willing to do those 3 and 4 hour meetings and listen to people and try to solve problems. We're good on you for running for school board. Tim Uwis for school board. I'll put a sign out for that one. What made you want to do that? What was the tipping point?
Yeah, I think the tipping point was looking at, as kind of a trained engineer through Oregon State, now financial advisor today, working with people, you know, helping them solve the problems or the things they're helping them achieve their goals. I just looked at it from the perspective of, you know, it feels like we've been so reactionary, and we were all very reactionary. So don't hear me the wrong way. We're all very reactionary, last March and April, because we didn't know, we didn't have a lot of data points. And then starting to understand more about what the rest of the country was doing and kind of what we were seeing locally in our school district. I think for me, it's how do we get back to a point next year where we can provide a full, you know, in person to person, face to face education, also have the ability to pivot to some type of whether it's through WebEx, Zoom, but a live in-person teaching. If kids can't make it to the classroom, they get the same education, and there's not a kind of quarantined group where my kids are under quarantine right now. They get about 25 minutes of live teaching a day. That's just not acceptable. And so having a better plan for the fall, that's part of it. Looking at getting youth back in sports is a part of it, trying to bring if we look at our local middle schools, John, we have track and field and cross country. And we wonder why there's a disparity in athletics today, because at the local level, at the middle school level, it didn't matter if you could afford to travel to Idaho to play basketball or not. You had a chance at the local level with your classmates, with your teammates, in your community. And I'd love to see some of those things come back.
Our guest, Tim Uwis, former Oregon State tight end, drafted by the Buffalo Bills in 2004. That first season, you score a couple of touchdowns in the NFL. You start 5 games. What's it like to score a touchdown in an NFL game?
You know, the first one, really a terrible story associated with it. Mark Campbell and I were kind of quasi co-starters. We both played 60-70 reps a game. That was at the time of kind of two tight end Peyton Manning style, a lot of two tight end check with me and with Drew Bledsoe as our quarterback. Very intelligent, good, smart quarterback. He was able to run a lot of that no huddle with both of us, and we'd actually had a second goal play, and I had a holding call. Willis McGahee scored a touchdown, so then it got called back. That was like second 12. We called the play, and I was really just kind of a check down. And I caught a ball in the flat and was able to run it into the end zone, kind of dove in. And it was one of those like, hey, I scored, but should I feel guilty about this? Because it probably cost Willis some money somehow, you know, on his contract. And so it's like, yeah, I can celebrate this one, but not too hard. Then the other one I caught was down at Miami, and that was kind of on – very similar to what we used to run with Coach Erickson at Oregon State, kind of the old wide delay play, and had a nice little, everybody did their job on offense. It worked out perfectly, and I was able to score. So it was a fun play down there. And that was really weird because even in a college game, I feel like, John, if we're playing up at UW, there's going to be enough Beaver fans there to make a little bit of noise. Mm-hmm. But caught a touchdown at what then was Pro Player Stadium. Now it's Hard Rock or something like that. And it was just dead silent. I was just kind of looking around, like just no Bills fans, just dead silent. And so it was kind of, you know, a unique experience. But both those are good, fun memories. If anything, when you retire, you miss the guys. And that's over this summer, it was with all of the kind of relation issues that our country was looking at regarding race, regarding equity, it was nice to connect with some former teammates that I hadn't talked with in a while to just pick their brains on that stuff. And that's what I miss, that locker room time. You don't miss scoring a touchdown. You don't miss getting the tar beat out of you. You don't miss tearing your ACL. You don't miss those things. You miss the guys. And that's the fun part of the game.
You're so right about a locker room, because as you look around a football locker room, and you know, in the college, even in the NFL, you see different races, different religions, different family backgrounds, different circumstances. You know, you're a white guy in the locker room. How can a white player in the locker room look around and be part of a solution, you know, with teammates who don't look like them or may not be from a background that they came from or may not be the same religion? How does that work in a locker room, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a tough question, but I think the answer is easy. You have relationships with those people, because when you're eating breakfast with them every day, practicing with them, ice tubbing, showering, eating lunch, going to meetings, eating dinner, studying, living life with them, all of a sudden, all of those things that can kind of divide us or put us into boxes start disappearing, because those are just the people you're living life with. And you don't even realize, if somebody said, hey, how did you and Richard Siegler get along as a white and a black guy and a tight end and a linebacker? I'd be like, that was irrelevant in the conversation. We hated each other on the field because he was a linebacker and I was a tight end. But we had a lot of fun talking trash to each other and watching film and doing those things. But also to pick their brain in the last summer and just say, hey, what am I missing here? What can I do to implement some change? It's the relationship piece, I think, that's so important in all of this. Having conversations with people that don't look like us, and then how can we leverage whatever power, privilege we do have. You got a second for me to share one story about one of the former players I coached?
Yeah, for sure.
So Howard Kroom and I, so when I was coaching at Oregon State, Howard said, hey, I wasn't sure about something you said on Twitter. Can we have a conversation? So we ended up talking for about 2 hours. And he had said something about, well, even a place like Oregon State has systemic racism. And I just said, man, I need to understand this better. I need to get a definition of this, what it means to me and what it means to society. And the example he used was me showing up at Oregon State and saying, I want to be an engineer. And basically the counselor saying, no, you're a football player, you can't do that. And me saying, yes, I'm going to do it. Figure out, I signed on a paper, but it didn't say what I could or could not study. But me having the self-confidence to do that, and maybe as opposed to some of my teammates that came out of Cerritos or Compton or, you know, difficult situations, and them saying, hey, I'd like to study business because I'd like to open a barber shop at some point. It would be good to have a business degree for that. And I'm just using that as an example. It could have been anything, ice cream shop, whatever. And a counselor saying, man, I don't know if you can take those courses. Let's just get you into the easiest thing you can graduate in. And if you've been told all your life that you're just an athlete and you're not necessarily an academic or that's not your forte, who are you going to listen to? You're going to listen to the counselor. And I don't want to say the counselor is racist. Please don't hear that in this story. But it's the principle behind it. And again, that's part of me saying, hey, how can I change this in my community? How can I, is school board a part of that, where we can have every kid have the confidence that when they go to college and say, I want to study XYZ, nobody tells them they can't do it. And I don't know if that qualifies as systemic racism. I don't know what that means, but I think it's solved through us encouraging every kid today with the goal of you can do whatever you want as long as you apply yourself now and build that foundation. So then when all these kids that are kindergartners, you know, first graders that had their first year in the pandemic for grade school, they get to a point in life where somebody says, no, you can't do business. And they say, man, I had my kindergarten during pandemic on Zoom. I can do it. I can figure this out. And I think that's a big part of the solution to this. So I don't know. Sorry about the soapbox there.
Nope.
I'm just passionate about it. I want to have those conversations. I want to help elevate people. So
Tim Uwis for School Board. I'm saying that today. Tim, I appreciate you making time for us. Fantastic stuff. We'll get you back on after you you win the election, and let's help some kids and help the community. I appreciate you, man.
Sounds good. Thanks, John, and thanks for all you've done to help get youth sports going back again in the state. I don't think a lot of people may not understand that, and I don't want to say it's pressure on the governor or her staff, but bringing scientists out with data to get kids active again has been so important. I want to thank you for your role in that.
I appreciate you, Tim. And, you know, I just think people need to be vocal about what they're passionate about and keep advocating for kids. Tim Uwis is doing it. We'll do it on this show. You do it in your households. And, you know, I think we're all in it together. Leave it here. The Culligan Water Cooler Report is next. The Culligan Water Cooler Report, we do it every day on the program. Go to culliganoforegon.com if you want to test your water or see their great products.
Welcome to the Culligan Water Cooler Report. If we're talking about it, they'll be talking about it. Brought to you by Culligan Water Company.
Well, Forbes put out the list of the 50 most valuable sports teams in the world. At the top of the list, of course, you know, franchise like the Dallas Cowboys. Also some of the soccer clubs there. But the Dallas Cowboys are number one, $5.7 billion. It's up 43% in the last 5 years. The Yankees are second at $5.25 billion. Barcelona in the soccer world rounding out the top five. Real Madrid in there as well. The Warriors are the highest valued NBA team at $4.7 billion. The Lakers right on their heels at $4.6 billion. The Blazers did not make the list of the top 50, but you better believe that Paul Allen made a wise investment. The Seattle Seahawks did make it, coming in the top 30.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.